This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Guy Caballero, owner and president of the SCTV Network. Well, tonight's pledge night here at SCTV, and we're hoping you'll pledge lots of money to our network. Now, some of you at home might be saying to yourselves, but I thought SCTV was a commercial network. Well, it is. But just because it's commercial doesn't mean we're making money. Now, you people out there, I'll be honest with you. If you want to see good programming, you're just going to have to kick in and help pay for it. You know, these programs we watch here aren't cheap, believe me. So why don't you just do your duty and pledge money? Lots of money. You'll help keep SCTV in the black, and you'll continue to enjoy fine shows. Shows like this one coming up.
That's Joe Flaherty as Guy Caballero, owner of a fictional TV station called SCTV. It was a low-rent operation run by a strange woman named Edith Prickly, and offering everything from public service shows like English for Beginners to old-fashioned variety shows starring albino entertainer Jackie Rogers Jr. In reality, SCTV was a brilliant satire concocted by the Toronto branch of the Second City Comedy Improv Troupe. The second DVD set collecting some of the best of SCTV has just been released, preserving and presenting some of the funniest TV satire ever performed. Cast members of SCTV included John Candy, Joe Flaherty, Andrea Martin, Rick Moranis, and four very talented people we'll hear from today: Eugene Levy, Martin Short, Catherine O'Hara, and our first guest, Dave Thomas as the Beaver. That's the way he was identified each week in the SCTV credits. Terry Gross spoke with Dave Thomas in 1990, when he had his own short-lived summer series, The Dave Thomas Comedy Show. Here's a sample in which he explains how he impersonates Bob Hope.
I've noticed some things about Bob, some little idiosyncrasies that perhaps some of you have noticed. Like, when Bob is talking about beautiful and sexy women, his voice goes up very high, like this.
Hey, here's Stevie Nicks with her new hit single, and then joining me later in the show will be Kiki D with the pretty baby herself, Miss Brooke Shields, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, right here on the show.
But when Bobby is referring to important people, his voice drops way down, you know, like this.
Now, I did
9 holes with Maggie Thatcher the other day, and I'll tell you, the Iron Lady can really smack a ball, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and we were out there with Malcolm Forbes and General Westmoreland, and then...
Gerald Ford joined us on the back 9. You know,
and then we went to the lounge, and Kiki D was in there, and we had a drink with her.
My favorite characterization of yours is Bob Hope.
And yeah.
I was wondering how you first did him.
Well, I'll tell you. What happened there was we were doing a thing. Brian Doyle Murray, Bill's brother, and I wrote a thing called the Bob Hope Desert Classic, which kind of combined two things that were real close to Bob at that time, and that was golf and war. So I really didn't know how to do them. I'd never done them before. I'd done kind of just the high, whiny voice of Bob Hope here in, we're in Phnom Penh, 50 miles north of the DMZ, you know. So I was working on it, but I hadn't really sort of refined it. And then when we got into makeup and they put this, this was pre-prosthetics, and they put a wax nose on me, and I looked in the mirror and I said, "Gee, I still don't look like him." And they slicked my hair back and grayed it a little. And then Beverly Sheckman, who was the makeup designer, said, "Well, why don't you stick your jaw out? You know, because his jaw is bigger than yours." So as soon as I stuck my jaw out, I had kind of a little cup that I could speak into in the front here. And that, for all you lame impersonators out there that are trying to do them, that's the secret to how to do them. And the minute someone else gets them down, then I'll stop doing them too. So.
On SCTV, you used to do Bob Hope to Rick Moranis as Woody Allen.
Yep.
Who came up with the idea to put the two characters together?
Well, Rick could do Woody, and I had done Bob. So, you know, we were always fooling around in the offices and kind of packaging unlikely combinations of people that would be put together, you know. And so we barked this thing into one of those little micro cassette recorders one day, and it came out quite funny, the Play It Again Bob thing that we ended up doing with Woody and Bob together. So we decided to write it up as a sketch from the notes, and we changed very little really from what we improvised, and we shortened it, of course, but we changed very little of the structure of the piece. And we just thought that Woody had, especially in his earlier comedy, not like Interiors and darker stuff like that they did later. But in his earlier comedies, he borrowed a lot from Bob Hope. He played the coward character and was always kind of like backing out a door with gorillas, you know, like he'd take the money and run.
You guys and Bob Hope was like, yeah, listen, hey, but I'm not the guy.
So that sort of borrowing the coward character, and he added the sort of neurosis touch. So we played with that in the piece, you know, that Bob would be talking to Woody about doing something together, but Bob wouldn't want to get into all that New York neurosis stuff that Woody, you know, was into, that kind of stuff.
I know what you're thinking, that this whole thing was a crazy idea from the beginning. There was such an irreconcilable conflict of styles that there'd be no hope for compromise, that ultimately one of us would have to give in or the whole thing would fall through. Who knows? Maybe Freud was right, that the whole story is written beforehand and that all you can do is play it out and hope you get a good part.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. Is this guy still driving you nuts with his crazy introspection? Come on, Woody, we got a plane to catch. Take it easy, ladies and gentlemen. That topical stuff we added to your monologue is going to slay them.
Jeez, I don't know. It's been so long since I worked live. You think they'll like me?
Are you kidding? Those guys have been sitting on aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf for a year. They're ready for anything.
So I hope they have Gravol at the duty-free shop. I get seasick really easily.
Stop whining, will you? Stick with me, pal, and the only thing that'll make you sick is standing on solid ground.
Did you ever do jokes yourself?
When?
You know, stand-up jokes, yeah.
When I was a kid, you mean, or stand-up comedy?
Stand-up comedy.
No, I just started doing this. Ironically, I decided to wait till I was 40 to try stand-up. You know, all the other guys that are down there at these clubs are 20 years old, and so I kind of creak in and try my jokes out. And strangely enough, the way it's worked out is that I've been using The Tonight Show to work out my comedy act for the improv, because I'm doing a show that I'm doing a piece at the improv for. Instead of the other way around, you know, using the improv to work out your act for The Tonight Show, I've been testing my material on The Tonight Show for the improv. It's funny if you get it, you know. Anyway.
Oh, jeez. I want to ask you about the McKenzie Brothers, another sketch that originated on SCTV. And this was The Great White North with you and Rick Moranis. What's the story behind how you started doing this parody of Canadians and Canadian TV?
Well, the Canadian show was 2 minutes longer than the American show, and so... this is when we were doing the half hour in syndication, and they needed something to fill that difference between the two shows, and they wanted to find something that they could do cheaply as well. So they suggested that we do something Canadian content. Well, we were kind of infuriated by this. That's a kind of a national neurosis in Canada, you know, that they're always talking about their identity and Canadian content and everything, and it's more of a phenomenon, a literary phenomenon, than it is a public phenomenon. But anyway, it's kind of irritating when you're doing a show in Canada with an entire Canadian crew, half the cast is Canadian, most of the writers are Canadian, and then the CBC and your producers turn around and say to you, could you do something Canadian? You know, you morons, this is Canadian already. But they didn't seem to think so. So as a joke, we said to them, well, what do you want us to do? Just put up a map of Canada and dress in ski hats and parkas and, you know, and talk like this, eh, like you can drink beer, like a... They said, yeah, that'd be great, and could you put a Mountie in the scene, too, you know? So that's what we did as a sort of as a joke at the producer's expense. And, of course, little did we know that it would catch on, you know? And people would come to us and say, thanks for putting us on the map, eh? You know? And it was like, oh, okay, well, you're welcome.
Okay, good day. Welcome to the Great White North. Go. Go again. Beautiful. Okay, good day. Welcome to the Great White North. I'm Bob McKenzie. This is my brother Doug.
How's it going, eh?
And whoa, did you hear about... Well, you can tell.
Okay, you hear about the guy who, like, was opening a beer, eh, and, like, went to drink and then did the stupid thing of looking in the bottle and, whoa, there's a mouse in his bottle, eh?
Real mouse. Well, I guess it was dead, right? Drowned from beer. And drunk, too.
Like it died had a smile on its face, eh?
It died from drunk driving in the bottle. But you know what the guy got?
Tell him. A whole case of beer.
Right.
So our topic today is how to stuff a mouse into a beer bottle without without breaking it,
the bottle, its
bones,
right?
So that they'll look at it and give you a case and not think you hosed them by deliberately stuffing one in, eh? It's like shipbuilding in a bottle, okay?
Right. And like the thing to remember is, let's say you get a six pack, right?
Yeah.
Six mice, right?
Six mice.
Okay. You get a case for each beer bottle with a mouse.
All you know is get baby mice and put them in there, feed them for like a month, and then Bob's your uncle.
Hundred and...
Good day, eh? We don't have time for you to do your math.
144.
He flunked out of grade 6.
Now, you wrote ad copy for a few years before joining SCTV, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how'd you get back from advertising back into performance?
I became frustrated and bored. I mean, there's only so long you can play second fiddle to a box of soap before you start to go, wait, this can't be all there is. And the guy who hired me was a very funny guy. His name is Harry Yates, and he had worked at Doyle Dane Burnback in New York. And when he hired me, he gave me a book called The Ad Man by Jack Dylan. It's a very morbid and depressing book. And at the end, the hero of the book is left on his front lawn. His wife and kids have left him. He's lying in a pool of his own vomit, and his life is completely destroyed and ruined. And Harry said to me, read this book, and if you still want to be in advertising after reading this book, report Monday at 9 a.m. for work. So I always had that book in the back of my head as you know, what the possibilities were, and in their most horrible form. And so then I went down and saw Second City, and I saw, you know, Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and those guys up on stage having a great time. And I started going down there and watching it a lot. And then I heard they were going to open a company in Pasadena, and they were sending three guys down there. They were sending Eugene Levy, Joe Flaherty, and John Candy to Pasadena. And Danny was going to stay, and I loved him and what he did. And so I went and just auditioned. And I auditioned every night for 5 nights. That's what you do. You do the improv sets with them every night for 5 nights. It was a really harrowing experience trying to improvise with Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and Joe Flaherty. I mean, these guys are real pros. But I got in. So I quit advertising so fast. You know, I mean, I couldn't write my letter of resignation quick enough.
What was one of the first improvs you had to do?
Well, I remember there was a life, this was when I was auditioning, there was a life raft scene, and it was Candy, Flaherty, myself, and Aykroyd on stage, and the deal was we were all stranded in a life raft. There was the usual sort of, like, emergency operation that had to be performed on a seaman, and then the sort of, like, don't drink too much of that salt water. All those gags, you know, from the movie Lifeboat and things like that. We exhausted all those. And then Joe bailed out. Joe, that's it. And I can't take it anymore. And he rolled out of the mime boat and swam off stage and through the curtain and exited. And then one by one, like, then somebody else left. And then I get the picture. I'm going to be out here alone. So I went third. And they told me afterwards, they said that was a really good sign, you know, that if people start bailing out and you're smart enough to get out first, then you pass the test, you know.
Dave Thomas, speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. He wrote a book on the history of SCTV called SCTV Behind the Scenes.